Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us for Spiritual Seasons, Vayera and Joshua 7. I want to start today with a couple of illustrations of the kind of work we're doing in this spiritual season. Some illustrations taken from my last few miserable days of life. I've been sick for a few days now, and I'm doing fine, so praise the Lord. But I'm learning more and more how careful I have to be with my body, especially in the winter. You see, the winter is a test for the body. I recently looked up a quick chart showing illnesses per month, and the one I found was for norovirus, which I think is the common cold, and it showed a massive spike in outbreaks in the winter months, peaking in January. I mean, we all know we get sick in the winter, but I was shocked to see just how different the rates were from, say, July to January, about 10 times higher in January. So each time I go through this test in the winter, I realize something new about how I'm doing life that has to change, usually something about my eating habits. I play back my diet and eating habits leading up to getting sick. You know, what was I eating, right? Try to remember, what was I eating too much of before I got sick? And try to figure out where I get off track there. And, you know, getting sick shouldn't be normal. Usually it means we're doing something in an imbalanced way that is putting a huge stress on the body. And as we get older, the body is less and less capable of dealing with that stress, with that imbalance. So now I'm doing a little pruning of my behavior in response to having gotten sick. I realized I was getting a bit carried away with milk just before I got sick, for one thing. So now I'll be cutting back on the dairy to see if that helps my sinuses. So that's a kind of pruning of my behavior and regarding my body that I'm doing in this season. So winter, since it helps us to get sick easier, is a time of year when God is helping us to pay more attention to what we're doing and what we're putting into our bodies. And if our individual bodies are being tested like this in the winter, we can assume that this testing extends to other scales, like our families, or even bigger, our congregations. Let me share a second example here of a kind of work God is doing in me now on the community level. The other day I had a conversation with someone here from Southeast Church, where we're recording today, and I simply misunderstood her, and my mind was off to the races, wondering what it all meant. And before I knew it, I had told some people in the community what I had learned. Well, here's the problem. I had misunderstood. And so that brings confusion into the body. So what is God telling me through this incident at this time of year? So, well, establish the facts firmly before you speak. This is a foundational rule for dealing with community. Okay, so noted. I purpose to do better in that way moving forward. So Lord, help me with that. But that's just a couple examples there that I want you to keep in mind as we, ways that we're listening in the season for how he might be helping us to have stronger communities and stronger bodies now. Before we turn to the Torah portion, let's take a minute to review. When we began the Torah cycle with Parsha Noach, we spent a lot of time talking about themes of reconnection to God, marriage, and the new bride. The new bride spends some time embracing a work within her that awakens her passion for Torah and for the groom who gives her the Torah. This work in the lower parts of the soul, in the emotions and instincts, are final inner steps of preparation in the fall. What marks the winter is the increased flowing outward of the spirit into the flesh and beyond, into the community, and beyond that too, into the world outside our communities, resulting eventually in the growth of the community. So each turn of the cycle brings an increasing flow of the spirit outward through us. But this requires an upgrade of the entire system from the inside out, right? We are to be streams of living water, like fountains for a thirsty land. But the spirit needs a purified pathway to travel through. The spirit needs a purified soul and a purified body and purified actions and a purified community to flow through. So once the soul work, and the soul is kind of the middle bridge, which we often describe as the mind, will, and emotions, once the soul work is done for a cycle and our emotions are in line and fully engaged via the Torah on the gut and the heart, the body and some of our behaviors and our interaction with community still have to come in line to be a fitting and holy vessel so that spirit can really flow through us according to what God is opening up to us for healing in this cycle. We listen for him to bring us what changes we need to make along the way. And now we're especially listening for corrections for our bodies and our ways of interacting with community. So usually he will let us know where to focus by giving us some kind of problem, like a sinus infection, for example. So we can't take these physical bodies lightly. They are a precious gift that we need to treat as holy. We know what is good for us and what isn't, and we know how to present our bodies in a holy way or in a common way. And God is faithful to bring along messengers to help us make adjustments so that the flow of the Spirit is not hindered through us. So be paying special attention now to what God is helping you to see that you can be doing differently with your bodies and your presentation of yourself. Don't allow a problem to pass by without learning from it. Getting back to our review now, last week we talked about the month of Tevet being the month that we are especially being given the ability to kind of bring a kind of correction to the evil eye, the critical eye. The critical eye is what comes natural to us. This is because the critical eye is focusing on the outer shell, focusing on the flesh only. In the month of Tevet, we are given a special ability to add to the left eye, the right eye, which is able to see more deeply, able to see past the flesh. This more balanced view is helping us not only see ourselves better, but more importantly, it's helping the community come together more deeply as a community now, as we see the good in each other, right? The community is going to come together more as each part of the community is seeing what's good in the community and affirming that. So, on the other hand, there is a pruning of the body happening, and I think that's a work that we largely leave to God and the elders he puts over communities. It's not the responsibility of the sheep to go around pruning the flock. What we all can do is to use the advantage of extra vision given to us in this month to open ourselves up more fully to the good we see down deep in each other. So let me give this to each of you as a challenge for your home fellowships this week. Make a special effort to see the good in the members of your fellowship, from young to old. I'm not saying you have to make a public activity of this, but just try to have this kind of extra mindfulness this week, paying particular attention to that member who maybe draws out a little bit of negativity from you. Allow yourself to be drawn together into your community. Again, we don't close our eyes to what isn't kosher, but by the same token, we don't focus only on the negative either, which is what's the easy thing to do. So as we turn now to portion Vayera, not to be confused with another portion, Vayera. This one is Vayera. We're going to see that the work we're doing now in this month of the calendar leads eventually to a more balanced view of God. Right? We've been talking about a balanced view of ourselves and of others, and we want to talk about a more balanced view of God now. and eventually a deeper knowing of him. So right now we're doing a kind of work that will strengthen our communities, partly because of a test is coming for the body, a test like Purim. God is gracious to bring this test because his goal is to show himself to us more deeply through it. So these ideas will be our focus for this parsha, this getting to know God better, seeing him with both eyes. So let's start with a summary of the portion. Parsha Vaera begins with God giving a kind of introduction to what he is about to do. He's about to reveal himself in a new way. He's going to deliver Israel from Egyptian bondage, and he's going to take them as his people and bring them into the land. The people are unable to hear this, though, because of their broken spirit and the harshness of their slavery. But God has a plan for breaking through that tough shell. The narrative is interrupted, you know, at this point with a genealogy that leads us to the births of Moses and Aaron. God then sends Moses and Aaron to talk to Pharaoh again. Like the first time he talked to Pharaoh, it was, you know, I'm going to increase the workload of the people, right? And so now he's going back. God tells them, go back, talk to him again. Pharaoh is unconvinced by the staff becoming a snake or some kind of water snake, something. It's a different word used here, actually. And we're off to the races now with the plagues. So Vaera contains the first seven plagues, the plagues of blood, frogs, lice, flies, cattle disease, boils, and hail. We can see that this portion, you know, because it contains so many plagues, maybe more than any other portion, is the portion of the plagues. Vaera is the portion of the plagues. So while there are many topics we could talk about in the portion, I want to try to stay close to the seasonal themes, themes about seeing and seeing the body, the forging of community before a testing, and the end goal of knowing God, deep echad with God. So let's start with that final goal of seeing and knowing God more deeply, because we're given a picture of that right at the beginning of the Torah portion in the second verse of Vaera. Exodus 6:3, so it starts in 6:2, Exodus 6:3, this is the second verse, it reads like this. God is speaking, he says, I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as El Shaddai, but by my name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, the tetragrammaton, right, the one that we don't know how to pronounce, by that name I did not make myself known to them. So it is from this verse that Vaera gets its name, from the word I appeared. He says, I appeared to them, the patriarchs, as El Shaddai. Vaera has to do with vision, with seeing. It means, and I appeared, and I appeared. So there are many ideas for what this contrast is between El Shaddai and Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Everyone is drawn to this unusual verse, but the interpretations are all over the map. So I'm going to give a reading that assumes that there is a process of development going on, right? That's our focus here, is development, process of development within the Jewish people. In that process of growth, the patriarchs represent an early stage of development, and the name El Shaddai is reflecting this early relationship with his people. Likewise, I'm going to assume that when God says he is going to make himself known by the name Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, this indicates a deeper relationship because the people are ready for that. Many people point out that the Torah uses the name Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh all along the story, right? All through the Torah up to this point. So the patriarchs seem to know this name for God, but it's one thing to know a name, and it's another thing to know the essence behind that name. God is saying here that he didn't show the essence of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh to them, even if they did know that name, right? They simply were not ready for that yet, right? They didn't know the essence of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. So let's talk about the name El Shaddai. It's usually translated as God Almighty. though I've also heard God the All-Sufficient One. I think both of these understandings work, but I'm going to focus on God Almighty, just perhaps a little bit more straightforward of a reading of that name. When you dig for just a few minutes into the name El Shaddai, you quickly see some apparently troubling associations. The word is thought to be the root, the word that's thought to be at the root of Shaddai is Shaddad, meaning to deal with violently, to devastate, to ruin, to destroy, or even just dead. So this is God showing himself to the patriarchs as God Almighty by virtue of bringing devastation and death. Another way we could summarize this name of God is God the All-Powerful Death Bringer. El Shaddai is put in the same category as the name Elohim, both being names that speak to God as he is expressed in nature, names that carry a sense of limitation to them, the God who puts boundaries on things. El Shaddai is the God who gives rules, but who remains on top of the mountain, lofty and so powerful that you can't risk getting too close, or you may just end up dead. So let's ask how it is that God chiefly made his Shaddai character known to the patriarchs. God the Almighty Death Bringer, right? How was that especially how he related to the patriarchs? Well, what comes to my mind with this question is that the generations of the patriarchs and matriarchs were asked to submit to death, to separate from the family and culture and world that they knew, and to just follow him into the unknown. Theirs were the generations that didn't have land, and that's huge, because they left the lands of their ancestors, so they didn't have a place. They were sojourners in a land that eventually grew a bit crowded for them and kept pushing back at them, and before too long, they went down to the narrow place of Egypt, right? Jacob himself goes down to the narrow place of Egypt. That's what Egypt means, that narrow, doubly narrow place. And I think we can include this revelation of El Shaddai, the years of slavery in Egypt, because God says it's only now, as he's bringing them out, that he is going to reveal himself by the name of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. So in other words, these early generations were asked to submit to God based upon some promises, and they did, and they sacrificed much. And they had faith that later generations would experience the full benefits that they wouldn't. If we're standing back and comparing those generations to later generations, in a sense, they experienced the death of submission to God, but not the fullness of the new life. God says to us, let it go. Let go of the old life. Release it, and I'll give you a new one. And this does happen, but the problem is that when he gives us the new life, it's like a seed that has to go through a whole long process to fully develop and bear fruit. And Isaac is called a seed. So it takes time. It takes time. They had to suffer through the separation from their homeland, and there wasn't a lot of time for them to experience the rest of it. They mostly knew the God who said, die to your former life, right? That's the God that they knew. So let's turn now to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, or the Tetragrammaton, we sometimes call it. This name is thought to derive from the three verbs for was, are, and will be. In other words, the name carries past, present, and future in it. It carries eternity in it, the whole thing. Eternity lacks boundaries. So in contrast to El Shaddai, the Tetragrammaton is connected to the God who is outside of nature, above and beyond. It is not connected to God's character of placing limitations and bringing death, but is instead connected to his compassion, his endless giving. It is a more transcendent name of God that brings in the element of the infinite and unknowable and unreachable. So here now is the beauty of what God is saying here. We have the benefit of looking ahead in the text to see a bit more of what he means by allowing himself to be known as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Again, we go to the final chapters of Exodus, and there we see the people of Israel working together as a strong, united community to build something together. They are building a house for God, the tabernacle. And then on one immense day in history, it was a first of Nisan, God came down and dwelled in a tent among people. He came down off the top of the mountain, right? That El Shaddai at the top of the mountain. He came down from there and lived among smelly, sweaty, jabbering people, right? The God who set strict limitations that the people not go up on the mountain or else they would die is now the God who stooped down to dwell in a tent made of human hands. So this, I think, is what God is getting at when he says, now I'm going to reveal myself as, you know, what the patriarchs couldn't see of me coming down and living among you. Even though I'm the transcendent God and the infinite God, I'm going to do it anyway. And so that's the irony here, that the vastly transcendent God, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, the unknowable God, it's that face of God who is not bothered by the boundaries, who is willing to submit to this lowliness for the sake of relationship with his people. There's something very poetic and beautiful here. The God who you can't put boundaries on is the one who comes and lives in a tent because he wants to know us, right? We'd have to say that this kind of living in the middle of the people is the apex to the book of Exodus. And this is God revealing himself to the people as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. He might be the unknowable, infinite God, but that's not stopping him. It's not stopping him from dwelling with his people and making himself known to them to the degree that they can handle it. So there we have a picture of the goal for this season as seen through two names for God in the second verse of Va'era. Okay, we're heading in this season toward God dwelling among us and knowing him as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. So let me just make a few other quick connections here. First, let's talk about why it might be that God is wanting to present himself so clearly to the people and so extravagantly. God is making sure, you know, through all these plagues and stuff, he's making sure that Israel gets to see him very clearly during the Exodus, and not just as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, but also as El Shaddai. El Shaddai comes first and Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh second. The destruction of the plagues is all about El Shaddai, right? The all-powerful God who brings destruction. So Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh doesn't come forth until the community is capable to work together as a holy community. We can see how intent God is to show himself to the people and how he treats Pharaoh, at one point hardening Pharaoh's heart. The text is clear that God does this so that his people will get to see more of his power. God wants to show the bully who holds himself up as a god getting flattened again and again, right? The bully takes a few punches, right, and a few more, and finally he falls down and taps out, right? He's had enough. But God says, well, hang on, my people haven't quite seen everything they need to. You're out a bit early, so I'm going to stand you back up. And so God stands him back up and flattens him a few more times until Israel has seen what they need to. So is God being cruel to Pharaoh, by the way, in using him this way? We can be assured that Pharaoh is getting exactly what he deserved. This is the man who not only held himself up to be a god, but who also decreed the killing of innocent babies and turned a deaf ear to the spirit-breaking workload on the people. Anything he got, he deserved, and it was mercy to allow him to pay even somewhat for his crimes on this side of the grave, right? We either pay on this side or we pay on that side of the grave, and it's mercy when he lets us pay here. So back to our question, why is God going to such lengths with Pharaoh and otherwise to show himself to his people? So I think a big part of the answer is that he is creating a unified body. Somehow in this process, a downtrodden slave people raised in Egypt becomes a distinct nation with a distinct identity. God is forging a nation by doing several things here. First, he's severing the people from Egypt by standing up the Egyptian gods and challenging them and allowing them to do their best, which is nothing. And they fall one by one, from the gods over the darkness to the gods over the light, right? We see a progression from darkness to light in the over the course of the plagues. All of them are wiped out. So belief in the Egyptian system is being shown to be ridiculous. God is separating his people from that system and that king, that Pharaoh. Second, he's showing them that there is a real God who actually has real power, and it is him. And I think third, he's drawing a circle around Israel, and he's saying, you're different. He's helping Israel to see themselves in a new light. It becomes apparent that God and everyone else can see a fundamental difference in them. He's saying, don't bother pretending you're Egyptian, because you're not. He's forging a group of people with a strong identity and a shared experience. They not only see God making a distinction between them and the Egyptians, but they also end up with a bunch of shared experiences and stories to tell about the wonders they saw, one after the next, plague after plague. I'm sure they had endless bonding conversations over the water cooler about how they got water during the plague of blood, or what they did to fend off the frogs, or what they saw or heard during the plague of hail. We're seeing the creation of a nation, a body, united through a drastic experience, and a body who, above all, is bonded together by the clear recognition of a common, all-powerful king who is far superior to the nothing gods of Egypt, right? God is making a body. All of these means of making a nation are in line with one of our themes for the season, the vision that leads to a more unified body. So lastly here, this forging of the body is being done before a great test for the body comes, a great test that ends with knowing God as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. The test that is coming here for Israel in Exodus is, are you going to stay as a member of Israel and go out into that dry wilderness, or are you going to stay in this place with the dependable Nile? Tradition says that there were some who stayed behind in Egypt, tragically. So as many as 4/5 of Israel stayed in Egypt, they say. They're not out there in the wilderness long before they get thirsty. And God allows them to get thirsty on purpose. There's a series of tests they undergo in that first year. But before God brings them to that place of difficult testing, he does this strengthening as a body in Egypt. Okay, he says, I'm going to make you strong as a body, and then I'm going to give you the test. And the first test is going to be, are you going to come away from this place or not? We should be expecting that kind of testing coming up, because Purim is not far away. And Purim is all about this testing of the body. If you remember the story in Esther there, if they were simply willing to say that they were not Jewish, they could escape the evil decree and save their lives, no less. I mean, their lives were on the line. But they knew the body they were in, and they stayed true. And in the end, once they come through, they end up knowing God better than before. So you see, we bring this body testing upon ourselves when we make a proclamation that we are in his body, right? I say, I'm in his body. I'm asking for a test. This is something we do periodically, is we say that we are in the body. When we proclaim that we are in his body, he uses that as a vehicle to bless us. And that involves testing us. So I'd like to suggest that when we put our Hanukkiahs in the window at Hanukkah, this is when we are making this declaration for this season, that we belong to God and his kingdom. It's not a small thing to do that. It's not just a pretty thing to look at in the window, and certainly not just that to God, right? It might seem like that to us, but it's not just a pretty thing in the window to him. We're making a statement. And God says, great, I see it, I hear it. Now, let's test that so that it can really mean something to you and so that you can get some fruit from that declaration. You draw close to me in that way, and I'll draw close to you. So we come to the other side of the testing with a deeper relationship with him. God basically says, I see you, I hear you, I see what you've said, and I'm gonna give you a test, and the fruit of that test will be you're going to know me better. But I'm going to put that thing you said to test. So let's turn now to the discussion of Yeshua and how we can bring him into the discussion here. One reason we do this each week is that we are studying something I call the salvation pattern, and Yeshua is the origin of every bit of it. His name means salvation. So I'm going to focus these few thoughts on how Yeshua shows us both El Shaddai and Yod Heh Vav Heh. Let me put forth that his first coming is more showing us El Shaddai and his second Yod Heh Vav Heh. So just a refresher, El Shaddai is that side of God that deals with boundaries and even death. At Yeshua's first coming, although he is God dwelling among us, he is hidden. He is not recognized fully until after his death. His first coming is marked by the display of his power in the form of miracles, right? God Almighty, God the Powerful. And so Yeshua is showing that power in his first coming with his miracles. And as for his teaching, his word provided boundaries that even exceeded the letter of the law, driving deeper to the spirit of the law. So in that way, he is a boundary bringer, increasing the reach of the law, right? You've heard this said, but I tell you this. You've heard it said that you shouldn't murder, but I say if you hate someone in your heart, you're already murdered, right? So he's bringing in even more boundaries, right? El Shaddai is the name tied to boundaries, one of those names. And his words also divided people. He used his tongue as a sword that would frequently split the crowds listening to him. And two, his first coming is marked especially by his own death, right? El Shaddai. Shaddad can mean just death, just plain old death. All of this is in contrast to his second coming. Now, we know that his second coming will begin with more death, as he will lead a great battle on the earth. But that will be just a blip in, throughout the course of his second coming, so which will stretch into centuries. So right at the beginning there of his second coming, we could say that's more like El Shaddai leading the battle. But eventually Yeshua is leading the world into peace at his second coming. So this peace is in contrast to division and death. He's bringing the whole world together in unity and shalom with his second coming. And when he comes the second time, he will be recognized as God living among us, like in the wilderness, but this time with the tent of a human body rather than the tabernacle. we will get to know God's essence in a vastly deeper way. I mean, just imagine it. Imagine us knowing who he is as he walks among us and speaks to us and sits around our tables and eats the food we serve him and laughs with us and cries with us and celebrates family events with us. It's almost too much to even think about. But this is more like the revelation of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, such a second coming, right? It's a higher revelation of him. So lastly, let's turn to Joshua 7, the story of the stoning of Achan. So after the great victory of Jericho, Israel stumbles when they go up against the much smaller town of Ai, and about 36 of them even end up dying. The cause is found to be Achan, who stole some rich stuff from Jericho and hid it in his tent. When God reveals the perpetrator under Joshua's leadership, all of Israel stones him, maybe even his family, and burns his stuff. And the last verse of the chapter reads, "And they raised over him a great heap of stones that remains to this day. Then the Lord turned from his burning anger. Therefore, to this day, the name of that place is called the Valley of Achor." So there's a clear connection here in this story to the idea of just how profoundly God considers a community a single entity, a single body. The whole body suffers when there is sin in any of its members, as Tim mentioned in his teaching. God looks down and sees a single being made up of many parts. We see ourselves as separate pieces, right? That we tend to see ourselves as separate pieces. But his sight is better than ours. You know, we really have no idea how connected we really are. So if God sees a community this way, we must purpose to do so too. We can do better than we're doing. I don't think of my community necessarily as a part of me. I don't think of members in my community as members of my own body. But that's just because I'm not seeing with the eyes that God sees with. But I'd like to make a different connection here, because I think we can see here in Israel's stoning of Achan an example of an attribute of the month of Tevet that I haven't mentioned yet, and that is anger, which might sound like a strange attribute of a month, but it is connected to the month of Tevet. So the sages connect you know, many things to each month, including an organ of the body and a skill of the body. And for this month, the skill of the body, I mean, it could be eating, it could be dreaming like we had in one month. And this month, it's anger, getting angry. So they say that this is the month to turn anger into a good thing by turning that burning judgment onto ourselves, onto our own evil inclination. And this anger actually is another sort of manifestation of the left eye, the judging eye. So we need to use that critical judgment against ourselves, use it for good. We read in the verse that, you know, in the last verse there of the chapter in Joshua 7, that God was angry and his anger was appeased by what the people did. Well, what did the people do? They turned their own anger inward on the sin that was within them, which was Achan. They expressed that anger that God had. God had that anger, and they expressed that anger on themselves. And God's anger was appeased. So there's a lesson here. You don't want God to be angry with you? Well, get angry with yourself and do something. So the sages say that this is the month to get mad at our evil inclination. And here is what Rabbi Aaron Raskin, says about this topic in a lesson about the attributes of the month of Tevet. And so listen carefully to what he says, although he uses a few words. I didn't look up, but he gives his own translations, so I'm just going to say it how he said it. And this is what he says. Anger normally is a bad thing. The Gemara says, One who is angry, one who acts in rage, is an idolater. However, when it comes to the Yetzer Hara, your evil inclination, the Alter Rebbe writes in Tanya chapter 29 that there is a time that a person has to use a raging voice and stormy indignation, that the animal soul has to be screamed upon, that the godly soul should scream upon the animal soul. In other words, when you find yourself in the situation, and this is Rabbi Raskin still, when you find yourself in the situation that you have a very strong desire to do something which is not correct, you have a terrible temptation to do something which is wrong, what do? You have to scream, and you have to say to your Yetzer Hara, your evil inclination, you should know you are Ra and Rasha, Meshuka, Metsuav, and Manuvo. You have to scream at your evil inclination and say to him, I don't want to separate from God. Stop bothering me. You should know you're bad, you're wicked, you're detestable, you're loathsome, and you're an idiot. And by screaming at the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, with this attribute of anger, one will have the ability to at least escafia, to push away and curtail his evil desires. And that's the end of the quote from Rabbi Raskin. And I'll include a link to that teaching below the video. But I know we'll look a little crazy if we go around yelling at ourselves like this, but maybe you can find a closet to go in to yell at yourself. But, you know, sometimes the slightly crazy-looking people are actually the most sane ones. So do whatever it takes to stop from sinning and keep your connection with God. Even if that means yelling at yourself now and then, at the very least, you're showing God that you care. So I'm going to leave it there for today. Thanks again for listening. I will try to put an outline below the video, along with that link to the Rabbi Raskin teaching. May God bless us with his revelation to us as both El Shaddai and especially Yod Heh Vav Heh. May we know him deeply as the transcendent God who yet chooses to dwell among us. And may he make us into the people he wants us to be. Shalom.